Ho, 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 hello, and welcome back to Bah Humbug, the Christmas movies podcast that would quite like to be an octopus in a Christmas pageant. I'm your host, Helen O'Hara, and today I am doing... Well, we're doing two things today. We're doing a little bit of a celebration of the Christmas movies of 2003, but we're also in particular picking one of those Christmas movies out that you may not have heard of and may not be as familiar with as the others. So let me just set this up for you a bit. First of all, 2003 was an immense year for Christmas movies. It was huge. We got Elf. We got Love Actually. In the States, they got Bad Santa. We had to wait till the following year, but we're still counting it as a 2003 Christmas movie. But also out that year, and also exceptionally good, is a film called Tokyo Godfathers, which is an anime story about essentially a foundling baby on Christmas Eve who gets picked up by three perhaps unlikely godfathers and crazy adventures ensue. It's brilliant, but I have to confess, I'd never heard of it until this year, to my shame, to my discredit. Thankfully, there were two people who were there to sing its praises and to remind us all that it exists. So please join me in welcoming to the podcast Ghibliotech hosts and authors, Michael Leader. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Helen. Pleasure to be here.
Hello. And Jake Cunningham, how are you doing?
I'm all right, Helen. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm not very well. I've got a bit of a cold, but otherwise I'm very well. I'm very excited to talk about this film because, like I say, I was completely in the dark. I had no idea that it existed. And I've just sat down and watched it a couple of times this week. And my God, it's brilliant. Where has it been all my life?
Well, you sound a lot like me from a few years ago, because for those unfamiliar, which I'm sure is most people, Michael and I, we do a project called Ghibliotech, and that began with out of the fact that I don't know anything about anime or Studio Ghibli. And so 5.5 years ago, we started this project where Michael would show me all of the Studio Ghibli films and I'd watch them for the first time and react. And it was brilliant. And then after we ran out of Ghibli films, we had to find another filmmaker or a studio to delve into the works of. And Michael selected Satoshi Kon. And so I went in, again, not knowing anything, into Tokyo Godfathers. And I felt very much like you are feeling right now, and just discovering this Christmas gem and the kind of thing that you watch it once and you think, God, I feel like I'm going to be watching this every year into infinity now.
Yeah, when we started, we had Studio Ghibli as our first sort of mountain to climb. And that's sort of informed everything we've done since, where it's maybe a studio or a filmmaker within Japanese animation or animation at large, where maybe there's one film or a couple of titles that are approaching household name status, certainly among film fans. But then also we wanted to have a filmmaker who had a discrete filmography that told a story where you could see that a developing of a vision or a career. And once you get beyond Hayao Miyazaki at Studio Ghibli and his films, there really are only a few other big names of a certain stature. And Satoshi Kon is really one of them. And he has films like Perfect Blue and Paprika, which did break through and are known by film fans outside of the sort of dark corners of anime fandom that we frequent. But Tokyo Godfathers is the one, probably out of his filmography, there are one or two that are a little less well-known. And Tokyo Godfathers is the one, and probably because his films didn't get theatrical releases within his lifetime, within his career. He passed away in 2010, but they have been gaining and garnering a following over the years. And it's something we've noticed, well, certainly I've noticed in the time that I've loved this film. It's become now, if there's ever a listicle, as there tends to be at this time of year, of alternative Christmas favourites, this is always quite high up there. If you're bored of perhaps the other films that were released in 2003,
well,
you could turn to this one.
It's almost bordering into favourites, just not alternative anymore. G-Kids, the American distributor, they have made a 4K remaster of Tokyo Godfathers. They've got a dub cast in, a new dub cast as well in the last few years. It went on to Netflix. And now there are screenings of Tokyo Godfathers in cinemas, and not just one or two. There are lots of screenings happening in this film. And it has kind of just in the last few years, even since the pandemic, it has really caught on. And for good reason, really.
Now, I should say, at the time we're recording this, it's not on Netflix in the UK that I was able to find. So I just got hold of a DVD, because the Blu-ray would have taken too long to come, and I'm very impatient. But it sounds like I should also get the Blu-ray, actually, from what you're saying, because that sounds amazing. But also, one of the reasons we're talking about it is you guys are going to host a screening, right? So if anybody out there is in or near London on December 14th, you're going to have a screening of this at the BFI. So it is... it's getting some proper attention now, it feels like. It's actually getting...
I should retract what I just said and say there are no other screenings of this film. There is only one screening, and that's on the 14th of December. Nowhere else.
Well, we have the ace up our sleeve in that it's a screening at the BFI IMAX, the biggest screen in the country. So even while there may be several other opportunities to see it, there are screenings in Manchester as well. The Manchester Animation Festival are doing a screening there. We are showing it bigger than anyone else, which is great to see, really. And it's something, a project that we've had ticking along in the background this year. Satoshi Kon, if he had lived, would have been 60 this year, and we've shown all of his features on the big screen, and we had to save this one till last because, of course, it's of relevance in December rather than in July or August.
He died horrifyingly young, 46, which, you know, many animators are barely making their first film at that point as director, so it's you know, it's testament to his talent that he had made as many as he had, I guess, but... But yeah, it's a shame to think what else might have come, you know?
Absolutely. But the films he did make, he made four films and one TV series. They were very prescient. They were very influential, impactful within animation and outside of animation. And it seems that every 12 months or so, there's a new hit film from some stylish visionary who points to him and says, yeah, we were inspired by that guy. So his films are always relevant, I think.
Yeah. Well, this one in particular, because... and I'm trying not to speak too much, mostly because I'm losing my voice, but also because you guys are the experts here. But it feels like this feels kind of ahead of its time. I mean, if you compare it to the already wildly dated politics of Love Actually, which, you know, essentially Richard Curtis has more or less done a mea culpa for in a conversation, I think, with his daughter last year, who challenged him on all the women being dreadful in that film. But this one feels like it could have been made yesterday. It feels like, you know, some right-wing politician out there is going to accuse at any minute of being woke. A very, you know, representative, a very broad, if you like, trio, if that makes sense, if you can have a broad trio. But you have... you know, a guy who is struggling with alcoholism and maybe gambling addiction. You have Hannah, who I think, you know, refers to herself in the version I saw as queer. I think we would now probably say a trans woman. And this runaway teen with them as well. So these are the three unlikely, unhoused kind of heroes of this film who are trying to, I guess, make a kind of Christmas wish come true. I'm not quite sure how to describe it.
Imagine trying to pitch that in the West in 2003. Considering, particularly within the animated form, imagine, so biggest animated film of 2003 would have been Finding Nemo. it's amazing, like, that when you just think this is a properly grown up drama that's being told in animation that actually is full of, in a weird way, Christmas spirit.
There's
joy, there's forgiveness, there's tragedy. There's bright lights. There's definitely a kind of Santa Claus type character.
There's coming back together with your family and reconnecting with people, no matter what, you know, bad blood there might have been between you in the past. There's trying to get over that as part of the Christmas spirit. It's interesting to me as well. I've talked on this podcast before about the very basic types of Christmas movie, right? There's the career person goes to small town and rediscovers meaning of Christmas. There's the member of Santa's family or circle comes to career person and teaches them meaning of Christmas. And there's three ghosts teach somebody meaning of Christmas. Those are essentially the models. And here, on one hand, it's kind of upended because you've got the trio who are being taught, in some ways, the meaning of Christmas, if you like, or just being put back in touch with their warmer selves. But also, I kind of do feel like it's closest to the member of Santa's family model of Christmas movie. Is that fair?
Who are you proposing is the... are they the members of the family, or is the baby?
No, I'm proposing the baby is essentially the kind of catalyst. And it's actually... when I say member of Santa's family, I'm including angels there. So sort of the It's a Wonderful Life model also is covered. But yeah, it is a sort of like Deus Ex Cradle. Well,
I mean, it's the first shot of the film, I think, is the baby's face, and it's part of, is a baby's face, and then that's part of a nativity scene at a church service. It's very Christian as well, which, considering it's Japanese, is quite surprising as well. Yeah, it's like, initially you think it's, oh, this is so different, this is so wild. And then in a way, there's a kind of, not a rags to riches, but there is that kind of street urchin Dickensian quality to the whole thing as well. And like this, these kind of episodic hijinks that they get into, and all of these like larger than life characters along the way. So it's got this lovely brisk pace that does feel like this. It's got this crazy, what was that Seth Rogen thing? The night before. Night, but yeah, in a way, you can see links to something like that.
I'd almost see it as a flip of the Home Alone films, seen from the point of view of the bird lady or the man with the shovel, in a way, because it has that sense of Christmas being a time where little moments of serendipity or little magic happenstances happen. And that's what the opening gambit of the film is that there is this literal baby left in a pile of rubbish, and it's up to these three unhoused people to deal with it. And it's a cross-town caper as well. So it's not a million miles away from something like Love Actually, in the sense that it tries to almost get the spirit of an entire city in this time. And it's technically a Twixtmas film. Are there many Twixtmas films that you've covered on the podcast, Helen?
There's a few. There's actually going to be another one this year, because I would say The Holdovers is also a Twixtmas film. Yes, that was Jake and I both doing mad thumbs up to the screen because
it's
The Holdovers
so
is great, spoiler. But we'll be talking about that later, because it's not out until January for some obscure reason. But anyway, that's a rant for another time. Yes, so Twixtmas films, you're correct. There aren't that many of them. I would maybe say Amil Amin's Boxing Day from a couple of years ago, which obviously goes to Boxing Day at least. But often Christmas is itself treated as almost a deadline, whereas Christmas Eve here is kind of the kickoff point rather than the finale.
Yeah, and I suppose what makes this difference as well is that the inspiration or the influence it's drawing is from a story that was turned into a film called The Three Godfathers, that was a Western made into a film in the 1940s. So it's not necessarily drawing from a Christmas tradition, let alone a cultural tradition that's similar to Hollywood or British or English language Christmas films. So it's really a rare film in that regard. And as Jake said, opening on a rendition of Silent Night in the anime form is still so strange, because we don't see that sort of spirituality or that sort of tradition on screen. And it's something that Satoshi Kon's really good at. He was always good at having a very personal vision in terms of his range of references that he was pulling from. He'd be having a film that was very psychological or dreamlike and nightmarish. He'll have a film that's a salute to a century of Japanese cinema, Millennium Actress, the film he made before this. And now this one is a relatively straight film in terms of his, the form of the film. It's quite straightforward, but it's still unique within its genre.
And it's a film, I'm always interested to see, especially anime, maybe unfairly, because I'm not as expert on it. I don't know, all of the breadth of anime, but to see something that is so much more grounded than maybe the image in our heads we have when someone says Japanese animation or something else, you're sort of expecting blue hair and pink hair and dragons and whatever else. And this is, I mean, in a lot of scenes in this movie could absolutely be shot in live action. So the question is, why is it animated? And I think it absolutely should be, and absolutely is, it has to be, as it turns out. But it's interesting to me that animation feels like the right medium for this story, even though it is so grounded and so realistic for most of the time.
Well, I think our stock answer when someone asks why is this in animation is that the artists making them excel within that art form. And that is literally the pen they're using, rather than it being a camera pen that Martin Scorsese uses in his auteur theory. But also, I suppose, Satoshi Kon, just to tell a bit about sort of his biography, he was an artist. He was a manga artist at school. He started animating at college. He moved to Tokyo from Hokkaido, so from relatively small town Japan to the biggest city in the world, and is clearly in love with that massive network of people and experiences that is Tokyo. And to some extent, you can't capture that and the magic of the metropolis in live action in the same way. And while we say this is grounded, you do watch this and the character animation in this is still quite cartoony. I don't mean that in a bad way. His films often are the other way around, whereas everything around the characters is all shifting timelines and perspective. Are we in dream or reality? This one, the reality is quite grounded, but the characters are quite outsize and quite, I don't say caricatured, they're very full of life and personality in a way that if you did have live action actors playing these roles, it would be quite pantomimic maybe at times.
Yeah, particularly some of the shots of Hannah's face in particular would be difficult to do in live action without looking like Nicolas Cage at his most extreme.
Exactly, and some of the gags are great as well. There's one scene where she's in the taxi cab and she's sort of flirting with the guy and saying, I love a guy who will just say, oh, whatever, and let me get out of the cab when I can't afford my fare. And does that thing where for one or two frames, the face of Hannah turns into the face of the taxi cab driver. And tricks you can only really do in animation if you want to just break reality for a split second to make a gag.
It was a very good scene that I remember laughing quite hard at that one, and I think there are some kind of action beats at the end as well, which would be very tricky to do well in live action as well as that. I'm interested in what you think of this. How does it compare to some of the kind of Christmassy tropes we get in the West? I mean, for example, I don't know enough about, you know, Tokyo weather to say if it often snows there at this time of year. Because I'm thinking about some of the other films that came out in this year, obviously, you know, Elf, Love Actually, Bad Santa, all have white Christmases, weather be damned. Is it a little bit the same here? Or are we slightly pushing reality in that sense?
Well, it might not land as precisely as sticking around from the whole of Christmas Day to New Year's Day. But we have been in Tokyo at the end of November, start of December before, and it's certainly got chilly. I mean, when we were there last, although we were there in October and did get to wear shorts, which was a bit bananas. But climate-wise, it can happen, but you've got areas of the country that are for skiing and then areas of the country that are for surfing. So it is slightly more extreme compared to the UK in that respect. Mm. It is surprising that it does that kind of perfect glistening snowfall throughout when we've just been talking about how much of a realist film it is in points and it only reserving the outlandish stuff for the characters. But sometimes with a Christmas film, you just have to assume that everything's going to be covered in snow and you accept that and that's fine.
And what about its level of Christmassiness? This is something I always often talk about in this podcast. You know, if we're saying that, I don't know, Muppet Christmas Carol is maximum Christmassiness, right? That has the trees, it has the turkey, it has the Muppets. I mean, 10 out of 10, no notes. Like what this one I feel like is calibrated a little lower on the scale. This is almost something that you could watch to get you into the Christmas spirit, maybe, you know, rather than being the kind of grand finale on Christmas Eve.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, Helen. So this was my wife's first festive film of the season. So this is recorded on we watched it on the 22nd of November. So I think ideal timing for something to lure you in like this, like not bashing you on the head with the festivities. And I think because of the setting, you are cold, you're out on the street, you're not necessarily in the glow of that department store, Christmas tree, present situation. But I do think there are moments where it's sudden you do feel that festivity. And a scene that I'd actually forgotten about and I thought was lovely and warm and just a real surprise is a moment where one of the characters, there is a strange gangster action film beat that occurs about halfway through the film where people pull a gun at a wedding and it all gets a bit mad. But one of the characters and the baby ends up in this small room with another character and they don't speak the same language. And you enter this room and our hero character is just having a hot drink and is perched on the edge of a chair. And then you suddenly spot that the two babies, her baby and the other character's baby, have been tucked up into a little single bed in the corner. and the lighting is, or the colouring has changed from that kind of grey and blue that we've been sat in the outside, because that's where most of the film takes place. All of a sudden, we're in reds and oranges, and we've got a bed and a carpet, and that feels like an incredibly cosy moment and a very festive moment, even though there's not, I think there's just a tiny little fake Christmas tree on the floor, and that's about the extent of it. So it's giving off the mood, if not all the iconography.
Yeah, and the theme of finding your family, it, running all the way through it, is something that it is a time of year where many people will be thinking of seeing their family for the first time in a long while, or first time every year, certain members of their extended family. And all three of those characters, while they have their found family of the three of them living on the streets, they all then have their moments where they revisit or re-experience that family that they had lost or they'd moved away from. So that's definitely an element that if you wanted to, if you're thinking of Christmassy films and that sense of, if you watch a bunch of them together, those shared themes that build towards Ultimate Christmas, where you peek at Muppet Christmas Carol, that definitely will factor into that if you watch it. So maybe not the pinnacle, because also I think that Twixmas thing that I mentioned means that it doesn't have that big culmination, does it, of a Christmassy day, Christmassy vibe.
The holiday never does that, does it? It's never actually doesn't have Christmas Day. It does everything around it up to New Year's, which is very weird.
Another Twixmas classic, if you will. Yeah, it's a good point. And also, like, this does end on a very quiet moment, I thought, you know, or, well, actually, it's just about to get loud. You sense it's about to get loud any second. But it ends on this very simple scene with the three godfathers, or god people, as they now are, kind of together. And it's kind of a contrast to some of that cartooniness, to some of those bigger beats, to some of that kind of scale that the film does have along this kind of picaresque journey to get the baby to a place of safety. Because there is also danger in this film. There is also cruelty and darkness and anger, which I also think is a key component, actually, of many of the best Christmas movies. It's a Wonderful Life, of course, being the prime example. That is 2 hours of being depressed, which allows you to experience fully the 5 minutes at the end of utter joy, I think. And I think there's a little bit of similarity here.
Yeah. What I really like about the ending, to let's give it a slight Christmas twang, it doesn't put a ribbon on it. Everyone's resolution, you're kind of given an idea of what that resolution might be, but you're not told and given that American Graffiti ending where the text comes up and everyone's explained what everyone did for the rest of their lives. You kind of just know that there is, you get given kind of 10% of a resolution, that there is something here. And then what I love about the way that the film ends is it gives you that slight angle of positivity, but still in the area of vagueness, that there is the chance of hope, redemption, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But then you zoom out from the final setting, and for the end credits, all of the buildings of Tokyo start dancing. And I do feel like that's Satoshi Kon just kind of underlining that message. Be like, you might not know what happens, but it's good, you know, because look, it's the city's dancing.
I thought that was is it Charles Fleischer, the sort of 1930s squash and stretch animation style? That was just magic way to end a film.
And it does link in with his other works after this as well. He made the TV series Paranoia Agents after that, which is a much darker view of life in Tokyo. And then he made Paprika, which also has the big city life as a key component. And it is one of those many keys to unlocking his whole career. These themes that recur is the city as a character, which is a bit of a cliche to say it, but often in that very specific case, the city does become a character because it's part of its own little dance sequence.
Quite literally justifying the thing. I think the city is a character, absolutely, in this. And you know, again, I haven't been to Tokyo, but I've obviously wanted to, read about it, watched all the movies about it and things like this. And this sense of very different parts of town that they have to journey through, it does give you a sense of a kind of an epic, picaresque journey, and not just, you know, some people walking down the street to the nearest, I don't know, shelter or something and handing over the baby. There's a lot more going on here than just what's our immediate source of milk and a blanket. You know, there are competing aims here at work, I guess.
Yeah, and I love that all the kind of establishing Tokyoisms of it are kind of squashed away or hidden in the background or behind a tree or like partway behind a building. Like so the Tokyo Tower, I think, is a great example where it's not like we've got an aerial shot, which of course it's animation you could do. You could just say, and now we are near the Tokyo Tower, but it's trapped behind some skyscrapers and viewed from a park or whatever. So it's doing that great thing of feeling like we are in the city, but not necessarily giving us that most glamorous version of it or a tourist angle of it. It is how it might be viewed as you are walking around it, and these things that you recognize do just peer and emerge from around the corner.
So there's almost, there's an instant contrast with Elf, which is very much the dream view of New York, I feel like. And I feel like Love Actually tries to do what you're talking about, in the sense that there are normal person houses occasionally in Love Actually, but so much of it takes place in really nice houses that I feel like it's not giving us the real London. So yeah, I can't credit it with the same energy. I feel like Bad Santa, out of the other films this year, I feel like Bad Santa probably shares the most DNA with this, which is to say it shares about 5% DNA with this, like no more than that. But in the sense of, you know, an ending that maybe gives you hope, but not a firm conclusion, you know, an edge of, I don't think this film is cynical actually at all, but an edge of maybe being a slight outsider on Christmas and not being quite, you know, you're not sort of Dickie Attenborough in Miracle on 34th Street fully bought into it. So it's a little bit more removed maybe from the traditional Christmas movie in that sense.
It's probably got the same blood alcohol content.
You know what? You're absolutely right.
Hello, I'm Martin.
I'm Sam.
And every week we get together on our podcast Song by Song to discuss the music of Tom Waits.
Waits is a writer, musician and performer. You might know him from his four decades of songs like What's He Building In There, Downtown Train, Martha, Rain Dogs.
Or you might have seen him in films like Dracula, The Fisher King, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, or if you made it that far, Licorice Pizza.
We're joined every week by guests from various backgrounds and disciplines, and together we take a close listen to his work, analysing the topics and tones he uses in his music, and honestly engaging with one of the most interesting voices of his generation.
Listen to our latest season or dive into our back catalogue by visiting songbysongpodcast.com or search for Song by Song in your podcatcher of choice.
So, Michael, were you watching Bad Santa for the first time for this?
I watched it for the first time the other day. Don't know why I'd never watched it. I went back on my live journal, back to 2003 to see what I was actually doing when I was 16. And I saw, probably 20 years to the day, I saw Love Actually, as we record. But I didn't see Bad Santa or Elf. And I guess probably the staggered release didn't help that. And it's strange because I was a fan of Terry Zwigoff. I'd loved Ghost World, his previous film. And as an adult, have got hold of his Crumb documentary, and I love that. And I don't know why I never watched Bad Santa, and it is quite it's definitely a relic of its era in a similar way to how Love Actually is. The shock value aspect of it is definitely what would shock somebody in 2005, and now sensitivities have changed. But the shared DNA is interesting because, yes, as you say, there is a thread through Christmas movies of perhaps the unlikely hero or the unlikely protagonist having their moment to shine or their moments of redemption. And that's definitely heavily played in Bad Santa. And then the innocence of a child being that motivating factor for them to change their ways or amend their ways. I wouldn't say that Bad Santa is going into rotation for me after watching it this time, as much as I think that Billy Bob Thornton and generally the cast give a really good fist of it. It's an interesting one. I read lots of oral histories and everything about it afterwards, and it seems that that was a film that was changed in the edit and taken away from Terry Zwigoff. And the version we have to see is different from the version as written or as intended, which is always fascinating to read about, perhaps sometimes more than watching the film. But the one I'm interested to hear about from both of you is Elf, because I've never seen Elf. I'm very good at keeping films as my rainy day films. And maybe I'll watch that with my kids someday. But I've never seen Elf.
Oh my, you are in for such a treat. There is a little bit of animation in Elf, by the way. There's a little bit of beautiful stop motion kind of harking back to, I think it's actually harking back to that classic American Rudolph, isn't it Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? Is it called Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? But it's about Rudolph, but it's that kind of stop-motion animation just to bring the North Pole to life. But it is, I think it's head and shoulders the best of those three, of the Western Christmas movies of 2003. I would now put Tokyo Godfather up, Godfather's absolutely up next to it in terms of the best Christmas movies of 2003. But yeah, I think Elf has aged much better. What do you think, Jake? Have you gone back to it recently?
When it's on TV, I've seen it like since then.
So every year then, yes.
I've watched it in the last 5 years, I'm going to say, maybe longer. I don't like it.
No.
But I think I've grown apart from Will Ferrell as a performer, and he's doing big Will Ferrell in this.
It's very big Will Ferrell energy and in that movie, yes.
I think I can see the appeal, and I found it appealing. And it's funny where it's not like I watched it and thought, that's not for me. I did enjoy Elf, and I can't bear him. I can't bear the Zooey Deschanel is so irritating. I do like the animation, and I like there's lots of kind of fun forced perspective trickery in the North Pole stuff.
Yes.
Like, your Gandalf and Frodo on the cart, all of that fun, making him look like a big boy in a small world. All of that's really good. But
it's the real world stuff that you object to, is it?
Yes. Yeah, pretty much. I'm going to watch a New York Christmas film, I'm going to watch Home Alone 2.
Interesting.
Fair. I'm not going to argue with that.
You pretty much knocked all of the cast members on the head there, but I'm intrigued because, not to be such a classic stereotypical film nerd, I'm interested in James Caan in this because when he, that's always mentioned as one of his late films that broke through, and people of younger generations associate him with Elf more than necessarily The Godfather. So how is he in this?
I think he's very good, but then I like the performances generally in this movie. And I feel like Will Ferrell's particular brand of craziness is beautifully calibrated for that character, who is meant to be a bit much. So the idea is, he's obviously, the premise, he's been raised at the North Pole by other elves. He thinks he is an elf until it is pointed out to him that he is twice the size of anyone else, and that he's actually a human, and he sets off in search of his real dad, who is James Caan's character. But I think that Caan's edge of kind of cynicism and, streetwise sort of energy, even though he's meant to be a book editor, which is not usually the sort of terminology you use about book editors, streetwise. But anyway, it's a lovely contrast with Will Ferrell's kind of manic, sugar-fueled elf antics.
Who's the kind of father figure on the North Pole? It's not Bradley Whitford, but it's like Bradley Whitford, and whose name I've forgotten. He's like a character actor face.
Ed Asner is Santa. You don't mean Santa.
No, I don't mean Santa.
Bob Newhart? Is that who you're thinking of?
Yeah.
It must be. I remember enjoying him.
He's great. He's very deadpan, very kind of holding back, and he's wonderful in it. Again, one of those late roles for him that I think most of the younger generation, that's now their reference for his entire career, because it has kind of swallowed all before it, hasn't it? But no, I just think it's a very good film. There you go. I'm going to stand up for Elf.
Maybe I'll come back around, and then maybe I had the formative I don't like this viewing, and now I need to have the formative actually no, you were just being a cynical, nasty man, and you need to regain your Christmas spirit by singing a song in the park that will create enough Christmas spirit for a sleigh to fly above New York.
You're not usually the cynical one of the two of us, Jake. This is very surprising that you've come out at so anti.
I'm sorry. Sentiment. I mean, in my I did the Sight and Sound best films ever made, and I put It's a Wonderful Life in there. Like, I'm a big softie.
Great movie.
Yeah, one of the 10 best ever made.
Yeah. I'm not gonna. I hate doing best ofs. They're my nemesis. They're such a big part of being a film journalist, and I hate them. Anyway, that's just slightly off topic. Let's talk about Love Actually just for a minute, because look, it gets a very bad rap, and I mean, intellectually, deservedly so. I do have affection for it, though. There are so many good bits that I end up kind of trying to blank my mind of all the bad bits. Because, I mean, Emma Thompson alone, fantastic. I think the little silly Rowan Atkinson bits are very fun. I think there are loads of tiny moments of greatness. So much of what Laura Linney does in it is great, apart from that final stupid decision to stay on the phone to her brother. You know, there's so many good bits. It's just maybe overall getting a lot more shit nowadays, frankly, than it used to.
I think it's, you know, rightly getting a lot of shit as times change. It was when I was 16 and I watched it, I was very into it. Perhaps not five star into it, but I loved the ambition of it. And it's a sort of ambition we very rarely have in the British film industry, to have a massive cast of this kind outside of a Paddington, Harry Potter, Second World War ensemble type of genre. It's very rare to have all these people playing real people in a contemporary setting. And it, there's a snapshot of a certain age of cast, all the way from Alan Rickman, Hugh Grant, Keira Knightley, gosh, Colin Firth, Andrew Lincoln. You know, you just keep going. They're all bangers. And also similarly, that sense of the City Symphony, the idea of a film that can try and embrace, admittedly, in this case, only Richard Curtis's relatively limited view of what London is, but trying to embrace a whole city. And it's one of the few films for me, in that sense of the Christmas movie, that gets a sense of the media hubbub of the 5 or 6 weeks before Christmas. Mm. How it's not just you and your family and going to the shops, it's also the radio, it's the telly, it's Christmas specials, it's talent shows, it's Ant and Dec, it's all the Christmas number one. It actually tries to factor in so much of the cultural traditions of Christmas into the film in a way that is very, you know, storytelling-wise, very ambitious. You know, we know that even though this film is incredibly long, it could have been longer. He had episodes that he had to cut out to keep it even two plus hours long. But I do appreciate that aspect. We don't have, I can't think of any British film since outside of the Curtis verse that try to not only amass such a good cast, but also tell a story on a scale like this. And I guess we even within Christmas movies, we point to The Holiday because that does a similar thing in terms of its scale, but it's also its cast. So,
but it really only sort of, you know, 5 or 6 star names in that cast, yeah, at most. And that's if you include, you know, her ex-boyfriend and so on. Mm-hmm. So I think that, yeah, you're right. Love Actually is on a different kind of scale. I think the closest you get is all those American films that tried to do the same for various lesser holidays, you know, Mother's Day and Valentine's Day and, I don't know, Arbor Day and Labor Day or whatever else they did.
I recently had to check myself because I thought Thanksgiving, when I saw that on the release calendar, was going to be that. But no, it's a horror movie set at Thanksgiving.
Yes, which I'm looking forward to seeing, actually. I haven't seen it yet. We're actually recording this on Thanksgiving, so belated happy Thanksgiving to any American listeners out there. But yeah, it's something, it's weird that there happened to be 4 such good, or at least successful in some cases, Christmas movies out in the same year. I had hoped that this year would be a similar thing, like it happens every 10 years, because 1993, of course, was Nightmare Before Christmas, you know? So I feel like there's something in the water in years ending in 3.
What's 2013?
2013, if I'm honest, was not quite such a banner year. I mean, there was Madea Christmas, you know what? Let's ignore that. Best Man Holiday, I'm also going to ignore, I'm afraid. Frozen, not a Christmas movie, takes place in the summer. Yeah. Okay, 2013 proves
maybe
me
it's
wrong.
Every 20
Fine.
Years.
Every 20 years.
But then that removes 93. But maybe 83 was
93.
Great. But that does mean you can get 63 and oh 43. God. Was four,
No, I'm no. sorry, that's not when It's a Wonderful Life came out. No. It was 46. Damn it. Look, we'll work on this. There's probably an equation we can do. But the thing is, there was something in the water in 2003 that suddenly led, like, legitimate stars, legitimate filmmakers to make Christmas movies.
Mm.
And that's a great thing.
Can I suggest a very half-baked theory as to why?
Yes,
and
please.
I wonder if it's actually because of a non-Christmas movie, which is, mm-hmm. or a non-Christmas franchise, Lord of the Rings. So we're reaching in 2003, Return of the King's out that year.
Of course, yeah.
But because of those films, Christmas was the time to go to the cinema. The biggest blockbuster of the year had become winter rather than summer necessarily. So they're all thinking, people are going to the cinema anyway. They'll see Return of the King. If they see a second film, let's make it a Christmas one. Could be.
That is for the, or also maybe, you know, the Hollywood stereotype, this is not my stereotype, the Hollywood stereotype is dad is going to Lord of the Rings. What's mum and the kids going to go see? And the answer could be Elf, it could be Love Actually. Probably wasn't Bad Santa, at least in Hollywood's theory. But you might be onto something there. That could absolutely be an answer, because that wouldn't necessarily have been the case for the first two Lord of the Rings films, because they wouldn't have had time to realise what big hits these were going to be and how much hype there was going to be around them. I mean, my only issue with that is you would think they then would have done this for every year of the Harry Potter franchise, apart from the time it came out in the summer.
Well, then they realised actually what it was fantasy, not Christmas.
Yeah, true.
And then you get your Narnias and all of your other failed attempts to cash in on that.
It's a shame. But anyway, listen, the main thing is Tokyo Godfathers. If you are like me and have never heard of it, I'm hoping that by the time people listen to this, it may have been added to, I don't know, maybe BFI Player
or
Netflix.
Like last year, it got added to Netflix on the 1st of December. And then,
fantastic.
So I wonder if it's the same thing.
You may well be lucky to be able to get it on Netflix. And if not, it sounds like we need to start ordering that Blu-ray, because I need to hear the dub as well. I'm really interested to see how they do that, because a good dub can be a fantastic thing. We should also say that I have done episodes on all three of the other movies previously on Bad Humbug, if people want to go look this up. But you guys have done a full episode of your own on Tokyo Godfathers, right? So people can look that up on the Ghibliotech podcast.
Yep, we did a whole mini-series on the whole of Cons career, and we called it the Conology to keep the puns going. And actually, if you do get around to watching that new dub, we had an interview with Shakina Nafak, the trans actress that voiced Hannah in the G-Kids dub that came out. So it's really good to get that sort of perspective on the film, sort of 20 years on, how it has different meanings and resonances and how they tackled that. And the podcast is still going. We have all sorts of other mini-series looking at other filmmakers. Another Christmas-related movie we did on the podcast was Nightmare Before Christmas, because we did Henry Selick was our most recent miniseries that started off with Henry Selick and then went into Leica Studios afterwards on a stop motion kick. And if we're in plugging mode, we also have a few stocking fillers with Ghibliotech name on. We have four Absolutely. Books now. We're up to four, aren't we, Jake? The Ghibliotech book, which was our first book a couple of years ago, which is every Studio Ghibli film, a chapter on every film. I do nerdy background history. Jake gives his fan review. Then we have the Anime Movie Guide, which is 30 more films from Japanese animation going deeper. Like, we have a chapter on Satoshi Kon there, but we don't pick Tokyo Godfathers. We picked Millennium Actress instead, but that's a chapter about his whole career. Then more recently, we did a book about Studio Ghibli for kids, which is called The World of Studio Ghibli, which was where we were able to do our sort of Darling Kindersley, Usborne type book. Like, how would that work for Studio Ghibli for kids? And then our most recent book, again, no relationships to Christmas, but it was a left turn for us. We did a book on live action Korean cinema called Film Korea. Again, 30 films offering a sort of accessible route into that.
No connection to Christmas. There is a film in it called Christmas in August, which is magical. Break your heart, but go and check it out.
Not set at Christmas.
It's got it in the name. That's enough.
Well, it's a reference to Christmas in July as well, which is they're riffing on, I suppose. But again, not a Christmas movie, but a really heartbreaking movie.
Well, I have to confess, I haven't read all four, but I have read your Ghibliotech book, and it's fantastic. So cannot recommend that highly enough, or all of them highly enough, to listeners for stocking stuffers and everything else. And again, you will be introducing Tokyo Godfathers at the BFI on the IMAX, for God's sake. On December 14th. So if anybody is in the neighbourhood and hasn't already bought tickets, highly recommend seeing this on the biggest screen possible, because it really is a wonderful film. I was blown away, frankly. So thank you guys for bringing it to my attention.
Thank you for having us on the podcast, Helen. A pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Helen.
Absolute pleasure. So thanks again to Michael and Jake, and see you next time on Bah Humbug. Well, that's it for this episode of Bah Humbug. Please join us next time for more Christmas movies madness. In the meantime, I've been your host, Helen O'Hara. This podcast is edited by Ben Williams and produced by Kobe Omanaka for Stripped Media. And if you've enjoyed the pod, please do rate us with 5 shiny Christmas stars wherever you listen to your podcasts. But whatever you do, happy holidays!
Just heard a Stripped Media production.